This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Jenny Pleeman reading today's front page of the Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. Blinken begins high-stakes Middle East trip aimed at Gaza ceasefire. Washington hopes to delay an Israeli invasion of Rafah as protests rile U.S. campuses and Israel's isolation deepens. Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken launched an uphill push here Monday to pause the bitter conflict in the Gaza Strip as it takes a heavy toll on civilians, inflames anti-Israel sentiment in the United States, and complicates President Biden's path to re-election. The White House's immediate goal is to secure a ceasefire that would delay an Israeli invasion of Rafah, the city in southern Gaza, where more than a million displaced Palestinians are sheltering. The Israeli military says Rafah is the last bastion for Hamas battalions in the besieged territory. But Blinken's goals go far beyond a ceasefire. He also is seeking to advance talks with top Saudi officials over an ambitious post-war plan that would lead to the establishment of diplomatic relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel, lay the groundwork for an Arab force to stabilize Gaza, and define a pathway leading to the creation of a Palestinian state. The multifaceted deal under discussion would also include deeper security cooperation between the United States and Saudi Arabia, American support for Riyadh's development of civilian nuclear power, and curbing Chinese influence in the Middle East. The intense diplomatic effort, taking place over 3 days in Saudi Arabia on Monday and then Jordan and Israel later this week, highlights the urgency for Biden as he heads into a difficult re-election fight against former President Donald Trump. A wave of protests over the war on the United States college campuses has heaped pressure on Biden from progressives to do more to end the conflict, threatening the president in states like Michigan that have large populations of Arab Americans. For months, the Biden administration's priority has been to cement a deal that would lead to a temporary halt to the fighting and the release of hostages held by Hamas, while creating an opening for talks about Gaza's future and facilitating greater delivery of humanitarian aid to desperate Palestinians. In the latest proposal, Israel has lowered the number of hostages it would require to be released at first and showed a willingness to enter a period of calm, a nod to the key Hamas demand of a pathway to a permanent ceasefire. Israel says this offer is the last chance to delay an offensive on Rafah that, if it advances, would threaten normalization with Saudi Arabia and provide fodder for more protests this summer. Hamas has before it a proposal that is extraordinarily generous on the part of Israel, Blinken said at a World Economic Forum meeting in Riyadh. And in this moment, the only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas. Hamas declined to comment. The group has blamed Israel for the lack of an agreement. Hamas representatives arrived in Cairo on Monday for talks with Egyptian and Qatari authorities, officials from those countries said. But with Arab brokered talks about a ceasefire deal yet to yield results, the United States is also discussing with Israeli officials how Israel plans to reduce the risk to civilians if its Rafah offensive goes ahead, U.S. officials said. U.S. officials say the Israeli plan to safeguard civilians remains sketchy and needs further work. The U.S. wants Israel to demonstrate adequate arrangements and a realistic timetable for providing shelter, food, and medical care for hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who would be displaced by an operation in Rafah. In the absence of a plan to ensure that civilians will not be harmed, we cannot support a major military operation in Rafah, Blinken said, and we have not yet seen a plan that gives us confidence that civilians can be effectively protected. Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan said Monday that bilateral agreements with the U.S. were very, very close, but that details for advancing toward the creation of a Palestinian state, a Saudi condition for normalizing relations with Israel, still needed to be worked out. The discussions in Saudi Arabia culminated Monday in a meeting between Blinken and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the day-to-day ruler of the kingdom. Blinken's next stop is Jordan, where he is expected to stress that progress has been made in channeling humanitarian assistance to Gaza. The U.S. says a further expansion of aid deliveries is necessary to meet the population's needs. The final stop is Israel. Biden set the stage for that visit in a call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Sunday, in which Biden reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to defend Israel, but also repeated the White House's reservations about an all-out ground offensive in Rafah. Meeting with Gulf Arab foreign ministers Monday morning, Blinken said Biden reiterated to Netanyahu that he wants Israel to take concrete steps to ease suffering in Gaza. Israeli officials have said the Rafah operation needs to go ahead to dismantle what they say are the four Hamas battalions operating there and the group's leadership hiding there. The U.S. diplomatic effort reflects the high stakes for Biden and Israel itself as anger builds about the heavy civilian casualties in the conflict sparked by Hamas's October 7th attacks on southern Israel, which killed around 1,200 people, most of them civilians, according to Israeli authorities. Palestinian health authorities say that more than 34,000 people have been killed in Gaza, roughly 1.5% of the total pre-war population. Their figures do not say how many were combatants. The protests on U.S. college campuses have disrupted graduation plans and led to tense interventions by police who have made more than 200 arrests. Israel, meanwhile, risks a deepening international isolation and fraying ties with its main ally, the United States. Pressure also is building in the Arab world to de-escalate a conflict that is generating domestic unrest, distracting from ambitious economic goals and threatening regional security. Arab leaders gathering in Riyadh warned that an Israeli operation in Rafah would be catastrophic and have urged a long-term ceasefire and eventually a lasting peace process. Egyptian Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly told the World Economic Forum meeting that ultimately a diplomatic peace process needed to be revived, aimed at a lasting resolution of the conflict based on a Palestinian state alongside Israel. Otherwise, he said, this crisis will continue and it will never stop and it will harm everybody in this region. Madbouly said that there was progress on some issues in the latest round of ceasefire talks in Cairo, but that fundamental issues remain unresolved. Internal conflict in the Israeli government and within Hamas is making compromise difficult from both sides, he said. Egypt worked with Israel on a reworked ceasefire proposal that it presented to Hamas over the weekend, according to Egyptian officials. While Hamas's political wing initially responded positively, the group later complained that the terms lack any explicit reference to ending the war, which is a key demand from the group, Egyptian officials familiar with the talks said. Hamas also expressed concerns over comments by Israeli officials reported in the country's media denying that they are willing to discuss the end of war or withdrawing forces from Gaza, the officials said. The Israeli Prime Minister's office declined to comment on the proposals. On Monday, Biden spoke with the leaders of Egypt and Qatar about the proposed deal and urged them to exert all efforts to secure the release of hostages held by Hamas, as this is now the only obstacle to an immediate ceasefire and relief for civilians in Gaza, according to a White House readout of the calls. The U.S., Egypt, and Qatar would work to ensure the full implementation of its terms, the White House said. Jordanian Prime Minister Bashir Kassawana said that in addition to averting a Rafah operation and securing a ceasefire, there needs to be a paradigm shift away from trying to manage the situation in Gaza. What we have to look at is an irreversible pathway towards realizing the two-state solution in the context of irreversible steps, he said, so that we're not in this bind again in a couple of years and in a manner that would fundamentally drag the region and perhaps the entire world into further tension and endanger global peace and global security. Amedia Eris' bid to sell sets off mayhem inside Paramount. The storied Hollywood company behind The Godfather faces its biggest battle yet as Sherry Redstone's merger plans collide with shareholder fury and a CEO on the outs. Sherry Redstone was finally ready to cash out. The media heiress, who controls Paramount Global, owner of CBS, MTV, Nickelodeon, and the Paramount Film Studio, last year started seriously contemplating selling the business. She began to feel the pinch of the entertainment giant's decline when management cut the dividend that was supplied income to the Redstone family for years. She showed friends photos of the house she was building in Turks and Caicos. The October 7th attacks on Israel left her motivated to spend more time on fighting anti-Semitism, people close to her said. So when David Ellison, the CEO of production company Skydance Media and son of billionaire Larry Ellison, raised the idea of a merger, Redstone was ready to hand over a media empire her family has controlled for nearly four decades. If only it were that easy. In the past few weeks, Redstone's journey toward a deal has turned into one of the messiest merger dramas in memory, with the fate of an iconic American company, home of Titanic, The Godfather, and the Indiana Jones franchise, hanging in the balance. Shareholders are rebelling over a proposed Skydance merger, bringing to the fore a central tension that has always been present in Paramount. What's good for the Redstone family might not be as good for every other investor. Meanwhile, tensions between Redstone and Paramount CEO Bob Bakish have reached a breaking point, and the company on Monday announced it parted ways with him, putting in place an office of the CEO made up of divisional heads. Selling Paramount would be difficult enough even without all the turmoil, given how it has faded over the past several years. The collapse of the cable TV industry has hammered Paramount, and its struggle to find a profitable path in the new streaming world has only compounded its troubles. The company's market value has plummeted by 80% on Redstone's watch over the past 8 years, dealing a multi-billion dollar blow to her family's fortune. Paramount has had chances to break up and divest its most attractive pieces over the years. Netflix and Apple, for example, showed interest in the Hollywood studio business, while former Showtime executives each offered hefty sums for the channel, and Comcast was intrigued by a potential partnership in streaming, people familiar with those discussions said. Though Redstone was open to some deals, like a Showtime sale, she held out hope that a big buyer, maybe a technology giant, would emerge to take the whole company off her hands, including fast deteriorating cable channels. But that didn't happen. The hope for any company in this space is that Apple will come out and buy them, but that's not a strategy, said Robert Fishman, an analyst with MoffettNathanson. Now Redstone is playing a weaker hand as the company explores its options. Paramount has been in exclusive talks with Skydance toward a deal that would net Redstone more than $2 billion in cash for National Amusements, the holding company that owns the family's 77% voting stake in Paramount, and a chain of movie theaters. Non-voting Paramount investors would get stock in a newly merged company. The current value of Redstone's Paramount holding is about $750 million, meaning she would be getting a substantial premium in a Skydance deal. A battery of shareholders have gone public with concerns that it would be a sweetheart deal for Redstone. Skydance on Sunday proposed a revised offer that would give non-voting shareholders a premium in a Paramount Skydance stock merger and provide less cash to National Amusements, people familiar with the proposal said. An independent board committee has been tasked with reviewing the Skydance deal. In a statement, National Amusements said it would respect the committee's decision on whether the Skydance deal presents an attractive transaction for Paramount and whether they want to continue to move forward. National Amusements has signaled that it is open to making a transaction contingent on approval by a majority of non-Redstone shareholders, people close to the talks said. Paramount has another potential option on the table. Private equity giant Apollo Global Management submitted a $26 billion offer, including about $12 billion in equity plus assumption of debt. The board had concerns about Apollo's bid, including whether it could arrange financing for a deal. Since then, Apollo has discussed teaming up with Sony Pictures on a potential bid. An Apollo deal could be much more appealing to Paramount shareholders, giving them a cash payout, but would not give Redstone the hefty premium Skydance is offering. Backus has told people close to him he has concerns about the Skydance transaction. He and his management team worked to find an alternative with advisors, including Arya Berkoff, a power player in media who runs boutique investment bank Liontree. Earlier this year, Backus floated a plan to raise equity capital to buy out all voting shareholders in Paramount, including Redstone, according to people familiar with those discussions. This move would have allowed Redstone to cash out and would have collapsed the company's dual-class share structure, creating equal footing for all shareholders. Redstone was not interested in the idea. In mid-April, Redstone and Backus both attended the retirement party for Sean McManus, the chair of CBS Sports, at the Grill in New York City, mingling with the likes of NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and former CNN chief Jeff Zucker. Backus and Redstone barely spoke, one attendee said. As the merger saga plays out, the business is in a pickle. The streaming operation, anchored by Paramount Plus, is growing swiftly, but posted $1.7 billion in losses last year. The TV business is shrinking, but continues to supply the lion's share of the company's profits, Paramount reports quarterly earnings Monday. Paramount is in a high-stakes negotiations to ensure carriage of its cable channels, among them Comedy Central, BET, MTV, VH1, and others, by cable giant Spectrum, with the current contract expiring at the end of April. Paramount has begun planning for what would happen if no deal materializes. In recent days, top Paramount divisional heads presented a plan to cut more than $2 billion in costs while investing more in content through selling cable network BET and Paramount-owned TV stations not affiliated with the CBS network and establishing a streaming joint venture. The goal through those and other restructuring moves would be to slash Paramount's roughly $14 billion in debt. Redstone, who turned 70 this month, fought a nasty battle to succeed her father, the irascible media mogul Sumner Redstone, vanquishing rival executives, nurses, and his girlfriends along the way. She has a strong attachment to Paramount. Sherry Redstone worked really hard to get the family business in her hands, so there must be a lot of personal tie-in to this whole endeavor, said Tim Nolan, an analyst at Macquarie who has been bearish on Paramount for some time. It's easy to say you should have broken it up or sold, but maybe it wasn't that easy with that in mind. As her father's health deteriorated significantly by 2016, Redstone assumed the role of de facto boss of CBS and Viacom, the two separate companies in the family portfolio, which then had a combined worth of roughly $40 billion. Had Redstone sold her family stake in each company at that time, securing a premium similar to what Skydance is offering now, she would have walked away with more than $10 billion. Viacom, once the darling of the Redstone Holdings, was coming under major pressure as cord cutting accelerated and its vast exposure to cable TV became a liability. In the 5 years through 2018, the company shed more than $25 billion in market value. CBS was comparatively stronger, bolstered by its high-rated broadcast network and rights to air NFL games. When Sherry Redstone pushed to reunite Viacom and CBS, she encountered resistance, with some warning her that the healthier CBS side could wind up damaged. If one of your kids is sick, do you make them sleep in the same room or do you separate them? One person involved in the deal recently recalled telling her at the time. Redstone, who thought scale would help the company thrive in a Netflix-dominated media world, was undeterred and merged the two companies, forming what is now Paramount Global. Redstone would have been better off if she had sold the entire company or pieces of it back when she took control, said Chris Marangi, co-chief investment officer at Gabelli Funds, which is Paramount's second biggest voting shareholder. The CEOs of AT&T and Verizon each approached Redstone about buying CBS in the years before she pursued its merger with Viacom, but she declined. If she had not merged the companies, it clearly would have been different, Marangi said. We would have all preferred 2019 prices for these assets. Even after Redstone reunited the media empire, offers for certain assets persisted. Apple has expressed interest in the Paramount studio and toyed with the idea of buying the whole company to get it, according to people close to the situation. Similarly, Netflix co-CEO Ted Sarandos has expressed interest in buying the studio, but Redstone said it was not for sale. Redstone has complained about Bakish's decision not to sell premium cable channel Showtime, say people close to her camp. The channel, an HBO rival, was known for high-quality fare such as Dexter and Billions, but it had an uncertain future in streaming and rising production costs. On Labor Day weekend 2020, former Showtime executive Mark Greenberg called Bakish, who was driving home to Connecticut, and offered a deal that would leave Paramount with $3 billion in cash and a 25% remaining stake in the channel. Bakish declined, saying he had received larger offers in the past. A few months later, in March 2021, Greenberg and investment giant Blackstone offered $5.5 billion to $6 billion in cash for Showtime, according to people familiar with the terms. Under the proposed deal, former Disney executives Kevin Mayer and Tom Staggs, who now run the entertainment company Candle Media, would have joined Showtime's board. Paramount's top brass did not pursue the offer. A few years later, another offer for Showtime came in a more than $3 billion bid from David Nevins, the former head of the channel. Bakish turned down the deal. Rather than selling Showtime, Bakish convinced the board that the best course was to shut down Showtime's streaming service and fold it into Paramount Plus, a move he said could save billions and improve the service's outlook. There should have been a couple of different times when you can look back and say, coulda, woulda, shoulda, Fishman said. He said Paramount's decision to put all its content into Paramount Plus made selling off company parts more challenging, as entities such as Showtime were now tightly integrated into the service. That wasn't the only potential deal that got away. Cable and entertainment giant Comcast, led by longtime chief Brian Roberts, in 2021 inquired about joining forces with Paramount in streaming in the U.S., as the two companies were pursuing such a partnership in Europe. Bakish resisted, taking a view that putting Paramount's new service, Paramount Plus, in a joint venture could further complicate selling the whole company, people familiar with the situation said. Lately, Bakish has taken a different approach. Bakish and Comcast hashed out a potential partnership between Paramount Plus and Comcast Peacock service without keeping Redstone or the board updated. The deal could be structured in different ways. Comcast could license all Paramount's content, including its CBS sports rights, and put it into Peacock, or the companies could form a joint venture with Comcast in control. Redstone told people close to her that the terms Bakish negotiated with Comcast were bad for Paramount, and that such a partnership would complicate a larger deal with a suitor like Skydance. Facing mounting pressures in its business, Paramount in May 2023 announced it was slashing its dividends by 79%, denting a key source of revenue for National Amusements. Redstone expressed frustration to associates, saying she had let Bakish convince her that cutting the dividend would be good for the company and would help boost the stock. Redstone told associates she should have heeded a mantra favored by her late father, who died in 2020. Hire great people, but don't let them talk you into anything you don't want to do. Redstone's company, National Amusements, which owns 124 theaters in the U.S. and abroad, was already struggling to recover from the pandemic when theaters around the country were temporarily closed. And it had amassed more than $300 million in debt. For financial help, the company raised $125 million from a merchant bank. The company still has about $185 million in debt. Skydance's Ellison came into the picture in summer 2023. Redstone and Ellison have known each other for years. They once had a dinner in Los Angeles that was arranged by her son-in-law, Jason Ostheimer, who is also her partner at the venture capital firm Invesit. Redstone and the younger Ellison would see each other at industry events over the years and more recently bonded over the importance of family legacy, both being the children of moguls. In December, Ellison met with Redstone and her son, Tyler Korf, at her Connecticut home. Over lunch, Ellison described Skydance's business, whose credits include TV shows such as Amazon's Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan and Apple TV's Plus's Foundation and movies like Top Gun Maverick. Skydance also has a sports joint venture with the NFL, an animation studio, and a gaming division. He laid out his vision: invest more in Paramount, restructure costs, and improve Paramount's data and analytics to better compete with Netflix. Redstone sent Ellison's proposal to the board a couple of weeks later. The deal itself would be structured in two steps. First, Skydance, which is backed by the Ellison family and private equity firms KKR and Redbird Capital Partners, would buy out National Amusements. Then Paramount would acquire Skydance with stock at a valuation of $5 billion. The valuation has turned heads since the Journal first reported on Skydance's financials. The company's expected revenue this year of just over $1 billion is 1/30th of Paramount's, and it is expected to generate earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization of $90 million. The Hollywood labor strike last year has weighed on many studios, including Skydance, but the company expects a surge in 2025 to $2.29 billion in revenue and $322 million in EBITDA. Under the latest Skydance proposal, it would put $3 billion in cash onto Paramount's balance sheet, say people familiar with the terms. Former NBC Universal CEO Jeff Shell, now a Redbird executive, would be president under Ellison. Amid the deal, talks with Skydance, a board shakeup occurred, with four directors, three of whom were on the independent committee, stepping down. Redstone had wanted a smaller, more nimble board for some time. The directors were told they would not be up for renomination. At least one, Nicole Seligman, an attorney and former Sony Entertainment executive, questioned the Skydance deal. If the deal collapses, Redstone will likely pursue a sale of just National Amusements without trying to merge Paramount into another entity. Paramount is trying to carry on business as usual as the TV world's annual advertising sales bonanza gets underway in New York. Its top executives are hosting a series of dinners this week with Madison Avenue Titans at the Chelsea Factory. Wall Street has spent billions buying homes. A crackdown is looming. Lawmakers say investors that scooped up hundreds of thousands of houses to rent out are driving up home prices. Wall Street went on a home buying spree. Now, more lawmakers want to stop it from ever happening again. Democrats in the U.S., Senate, and House have sponsored legislation that would force large owners of single-family homes to sell houses to family buyers. A Republican's bill in the Ohio State Legislature aims to drive out institutional owners through heavy taxation. Lawmakers in Nebraska, California, New York, Minnesota, and North Carolina are among those proposing similar laws. While homeowner associations for years have sought to stop investors from buying and renting out houses in their neighborhoods, the legislative proposals represent a new effort by elected officials to regulate Wall Street's appetite for single-family homes. These lawmakers say that investors have scooped up hundreds of thousands of houses to rent out, are contributing to the dearth of homes for sale and driving up home prices. They argue that investors buying has made it harder for the first-time buyers to compete with Wall Street-backed investment firms and their all-cash offers. Investors of all sizes spent billions of dollars buying homes during the pandemic. At the 2022 peak, they bought more than one in every four single-family homes sold. Though more recently, their activity has slowed as interest rates rose and supply became tighter. Two of the largest home buying firms, Invitation Homes and AMH, are publicly traded companies, while a number of other companies backed by private equity hold portfolios of tens of thousands of homes nationwide. Companies that buy single-family homes say that their businesses provide renters the opportunity to live in desirable neighborhoods where they otherwise could not afford to buy. With home prices and rents near record highs around the United States, legislators and officials at all levels of government have become more active on housing issues. States have passed new measures to fund more affordable houses, to allow builders to bypass local zoning laws, and to make the eviction process more favorable to tenants. Most calls to block large companies from snapping up homes come from liberals, but some conservatives also show an inclination to crack down. This corporate large-scale buying of residential homes seems to be distorting the market and making it harder for the average Texan to purchase a home, Republican Governor Greg Abbott wrote on X last month. This must be added to the legislative agenda to protect Texas families. Close to equal numbers of voting-age Republicans and Democrats said that they would support a measure to block Wall Street firms from buying homes, according to a new study funded by the University of California, Santa Barbara, and the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank. The study gauged opinion from 5,000 renters and homeowners in urban and suburban zip codes. Proposals to curb investors might be popular with voters, but so far they have not gained much traction in legislatures. None of the bills in Congress or in any of the state houses has reached a floor vote. Advocates for the single-family rental industry, such as the National Rental Home Council, oppose such legislation and blame rising prices on an undersupply of new construction homes. They also point to the relatively low number of homes owned by institutional investors, defined as those companies with portfolios of 1,000 homes or more. Some research estimates these companies own 3 to 5% of American rental homes. In some American cities, institutional investors hold a much larger share of homes than they hold nationally. In Atlanta, nearly 11% of all rental homes in the five-county area are now owned by three real estate companies, a recent study by researchers at Georgia State University found. A 2022 analysis by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development said 21% of Atlanta rental homes were owned by some large institution. Representative Nikema Williams, Democrat of Georgia from the Atlanta area, in December co-sponsored the End Hedge Fund Control of American Homes Act in the United States House. The act won't solve all of the problems, but it will definitely make an impact, she said in an interview. Critics of regulation note that many of the largest investors have bought very few or no homes in the past year. The great trade is done, said John Burns, founder of the eponymous housing research and consulting firm. So what are you trying to stop? Smaller investors that own between 10 and 99 homes have stepped up their share of home buying this year, Burns said. Some of the proposed legislation would also target these smaller investors. The bills in the House and Senate would cap rental home ownership at no more than 50 for many companies, requiring them to sell off any more they already own. A bill in Minnesota, meanwhile, would limit ownership to 20 homes. Bills to block landlords in the Ohio and Nebraska state legislatures were written in response to a small number of investors buying up hundreds of homes in a handful of Cincinnati and Omaha neighborhoods. Louis Blessing III, a Republican representing suburbs of Cincinnati in the Ohio Senate, introduced a bill to tax large landlords so heavily that they would feel likely compelled to sell their properties. Blessing said he is concerned about real estate companies developing monopoly power in some neighborhoods while putting starter homes further out of reach for home buyers. It's an antitrust in spirit bill, he said. AI startups have plenty of cash. They often don't yet have a business. Some startups are raising hundreds of millions of dollars before having a product or revenue. Artificial intelligence startup Imbue has hoodies branded with its circular orange logo, an office in the heart of San Francisco, and marquee investors who lavished the company with more than $210 million. Work and life blend together for its few dozen employees who share their emotions with one another at a weekly event called Feelings Friday to build trust and connection. More than 2 years into its founding, what the startup doesn't have is a business or a product that could create one. Despite a broad downturn in the startup sector, investors chasing the stock market successes of NVIDIA and Microsoft have deluged AI upstarts with record levels of funding, minting dozens of companies with billion-dollar valuations in the past year. The investment frenzy is already fueling concerns of a bubble as startups struggle to translate the hype into revenue. Everyone believes that AI is the future, so we are going to see an extraordinary amount of investment until proven otherwise, said Alex Clayton, a general partner at the venture firm Meritech. The problem is that we don't know what these business models are going to look like at scale. You can have theories about it, but you really don't know. Fears of rising startup valuations aren't new in Silicon Valley. But the AI gold rush is notable because investors are writing massive checks, sometimes in the hundreds of millions of dollars, just to get these companies off the ground. Even during the peak of the startup boom, such large financings were reserved for later stage private companies gearing up for aggressive growth. Imbue hit a valuation of more than $1 billion with its fundraising last year, courting backers like NVIDIA and ex-Google CEO Eric Schmidt. Chief Executive Kanjun Ki dazzled investors with a vision to build intelligent computers that could give humans the freedom, dignity, and agency to do the things we love. Last November, she lavished her employees with a company offsite to Japan. Imbue is plowing its cash into developing AI models that it hopes will one day create autonomous AI agents. A company spokesperson said it made a deliberate strategic decision not to commercialize in order to focus on research and that investors were on board with this approach. Unlike traditional software companies, the language models underpinning generative AI apps like conversational chatbots are expensive to build. Training them requires data centers with electricity needs so intense that industry leaders are warning that power grids won't be able to keep up with the demand. Last year, investors poured $21.8 billion into generative AI deals, up fivefold from the prior year, according to the research firm CB Insights. The average round size for those deals was $51 million, compared with the industry average of $8 million. Tech giants including Microsoft and Amazon contributed to the upswell in funding, with the added benefit of seeing their investments flow back to them through cloud computing contracts. Venture capitalists are betting that some of these startups will be the pioneers in a tech revolution that could outshine even the birth of the internet. They point to the meteoric rise of OpenAI, whose chatbot ChatGPT became the fastest growing consumer app in internet history. OpenAI went from zero to more than $1 billion in revenue last year, a brisk growth rate even by the breakneck standards of Silicon Valley. So far, few other startups with similarly large ambitions have been able to replicate that success. One example is Infection AI, the buzzy AI startup co-founded by LinkedIn founder Reid Hoffman and backed by tech billionaires, including Bill Gates. In the year after it was founded, Infection raised $1.5 billion to develop the language models powering its main product, a chatbot called Pi that gave emotional support to its users. But the company could not find a business model that worked. Last month, Infection chief executive Mustafa Suleiman most of his staff decamped to Microsoft, leaving Infection a shell of its former self. The startup has a new CEO and is trying a new strategy of selling its software to businesses. Other startups that raise funding rounds of more than $100 million generate little or no revenue. They include the digital avatar creator Character AI, which raised $150 million last year from investors including the venture firm Andreessen Horowitz, and Magic AI, a coding assistant startup that raised $117 million in February. Some generative AI startups that received early funding from venture capitalists such as Jesper and Tome have also had to lay off staff after seeing slower than expected revenue growth. It's almost a curse if you're an early AI company and you have revenue, because then you get valued on the numbers, not just the story, said Clayton of Meritech Capital. The funding rush paired with a lag in production adoption has resulted in skewed economics for generative AI startups. At its annual AI summit in March, the venture firm Sequoia Capital estimated that the industry sank around $50 billion into state-of-the-art NVIDIA chips needed to train language models. By contrast, generative AI startups brought in $3 billion in revenue. Everybody's assuming if you build it, they will come. AI is a field of dreams, said Sonia Huang, a Sequoia partner at the event. The amount of money it takes to build this stuff has vastly exceeded the amount of money coming out so far, so we've got some real problems to fix. Venture capitalists, including Huang, predict that revenue will take off as the technology becomes cheaper and more reliable. There are also early signs that businesses are beginning to embrace generative AI. In February, the buy now, pay later app Klarna said that an AI assistant powered by OpenAI was doing the same work as 700 customer service agents. But most companies have been hesitant to increase spending on generative AI, which remains error-prone and expensive to use. The limitations have led some investors to urge a more cautious approach to valuing startups selling such services. For the companies that raised 2-3 years back, you're seeing that revenues are not catching up with valuations, said Umesh Padval, managing director at the venture firm Tom West Ventures. The use cases are still not there. Brad Gerstner, founder of investment firm Altimeter Capital, which has backed tech hits like Uber and Snowflake, said in a March podcast that generative AI revenue should be viewed as experimental rather than stable recurring revenue typically used to value software companies. At Altimeter, when discussing revenue from AI companies, investors are banned from using the term ARR, which stands for annual recurring revenue, and typically describes money trade from software subscriptions, Gerstner said. Not everyone is taking such a sober approach. Last fall, a team of young startup researchers working out of an apartment in New York's Upper East Side began developing an AI tool that helps software engineers complete difficult coding tasks. They raised $21 million from investors, including venture firm Founders Fund, in March, just a few weeks after formally incorporating the business called Cognition AI. The startup has lower research costs than others because it does not build its own language models, instead relying on those provided by OpenAI, but it has not publicly released a product. Cognition recently closed a new round of funding, valuing it at $2 billion. House Republicans' bench thins, yet daredevils cannot quit skydiving. Why some GOP lawmakers' weekend adventures are causing jitters in Washington. They're going where in June? Washington, D.C. The first text message Representative Rudy Yakim, Republican of Indiana, sent after skydiving in January was to House Majority Whip Tom Emmer to tell him that he was okay and that Republicans' ranks had not been further diminished. "Don't worry, Tom, your whip count is still safe," he wrote. It was half jest, half reassurance. Yakim is among a group of adrenaline junkies in the Republican conference embracing extreme sports in their free time, which might make for fun office chatter if the GOP didn't have a razor-thin 217-212 majority in the House. That math means every member sidelined by a weekend warrior mishap is a possible legislative crisis. Any organization, of course, worries about its key executives or star athlete missing the action over off-the-clock pursuits gone wrong, whether a wild boar encounter or motorcycle accident. But Republicans control the chamber with one of the tightest majorities in U.S. history, slimmed by resignations and the expulsion of Representative George Santos. Each member's attendance is critical. It took two tries to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas due to GOP absences. More exits could, in theory, cost Republicans control of the chamber to Democrats before the next elections. Representative Nicole Malliotakis, Republican of New York, 43 years old, joked to House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican in Louisiana, ahead of Easter recess that he should remind lawmakers to avoid risky activities while on break. "No bungee jumping, no swimming with sharks, no skydiving," she recalls telling him. Lawmakers say Johnson hasn't leaned on members to take more precautions. Asked for comment, his office said the speaker is always encouraging all members to honor the full duration of their terms in order to be as effective as possible in advancing our conservative priorities. For now, many GOP daredevils remain undeterred. Consider the dozen or so Republican lawmakers orchestrating a tribute to mark D-Day's 80th anniversary. Their plan? Parachute from a World War II-era plane onto the beaches of Normandy this June. "Everything is vintage except the parachutes are new," says Representative Mike Waltz, Republican of Florida, 50 years old, who served as a Green Beret and is part of this crew. Some in the contingent have completed a practice jump together. Waltz, meanwhile, also still scuba dives and surfs back home in his coastal district, which he refers to as the shark bite capital of the world. Representative Rich McCormick, Republican of Georgia, a former American Gladiator contestant and emergency room doctor, is part of the D-Day skydiving group. He also rides a skateboard around the U.S. Capitol and is gearing up to play in a summer rugby tournament. "This is who I am," says McCormick, 55 years old, who recalls flying helicopters with night vision goggles in the U.S. Marines. "You can't change who you are because of the job you have." Representative Troy Balderson, Republican of Ohio, 62 years old, has participated in off-road motorcycle races and says his body has pins and plates from the hobby. He wears a helmet and protective gear, but says he hasn't changed his riding behavior. "Business as usual," Balderson declares. "The good Lord's over me." Some off-hours pursuits are more serious. Army combat veteran Representative Corey Mills, 43 years old, went to Haiti last month to rescue Americans he says were vulnerable to kidnapping and ransom. The Florida Republican says he took the usual safety precautions as he and several ex-military friends flew in by helicopter to complete the mission. "I've never considered that if I die that I'm somehow going to toss the majority," he says of party politics. He adds that his concern was for the people who were over there and might not have another day. Johnson has said he does not expect his numbers to worsen and play down the chances of losing control of the chamber. "I hope and believe that's the end of the exits for now," Johnson said in March, shortly after now ex-Representative Mike Gallagher, Republican of Wisconsin, announced his plan to leave. Since the congressional session began in January 2023, various Republicans have missed votes due to injuries and illnesses. Representative Hal Rogers, Republican of Kentucky, 86 years old, was out after a car accident while Representative Greg Stube, Republican of Florida, 45 years old, was hospitalized after falling off a ladder at his home. GOP Representative Frank Lucas, a 64-year-old Oklahoma rancher, says he has been more cautious about all things cattle after winding up on the wrong side of a stray bull that wandered onto his ranch last fall, leaving him with a broken hip. We all have to be more careful. Even routine sports can pack a punch, as seen when Representative Bob Latta, Republican of Ohio, 68 years old, was wheeled into a recent House vote with his foot in a boot, courtesy of a pickleball mishap. His spokesman said it will not impede his ability to dutifully serve and represent his constituents. Representative Emmer, the majority whip, who is in charge of head count and corralling Republican House members for votes, says he did give Representative James Comer, Republican from Kentucky, a talking to after the congressman took a spill on a Wyoming mountain biking trail. Comer, 51 years old, says a wrong turn onto an advanced trail sent him flying, leaving him with blood streaming down his cheeks from a cut above his eyebrow. "I suggested that maybe you don't want to do that kind of stuff," Emmer told Comer. "I agree with him," recalls Comer. "He hasn't been mountain biking since." For Yakim, skydiving to celebrate his 40th birthday was part of what he called a personal mission to desensitize himself from things that scare him. "Part of it's daredevil tendencies," he says, "but more than that, it is a desire to have no fear. It's much deeper than that." Executive flights on corporate jets worth millions more than reported. Wall Street Journal analysis shows wide gap between what companies report spending on CEOs' personal travel and what it would have cost the executives. Companies report spending millions of dollars to fly top executives to vacation homes and resorts. For the executives, the savings are far higher. Disney said it spent almost $800,000 for Bob Iger to use company aircraft for personal trips in the last fiscal year. Taking similar trips at his own expense would have cost the chief executive more than $2 million, a Wall Street Journal analysis found. The same is true for other executives. Netflix co-founder Reed Hastings took personal flights on company aircraft in 2022 that would have cost him about $2.2 million by journal estimates. The company reported spending about half as much. Chief Executive David Calhoun's personal flights on Boeing's TAB would have cost him $1.25 million, more than double what the company said it spent. At many of the biggest U.S. companies, CEOs and other executives are getting tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars more in flight benefits than company disclosures suggest. The contrast underscores the gap, already stark with the stock and options that make up the bulk of CEO pay, between the reported costs of executive compensation and the benefit executives receive. Executive jet use is also under heightened scrutiny after the IRS has announced a plan to audit personal aircraft use by executives and wealthy individuals. The corporate jet looms large among the perks that the biggest U.S. companies offer their top executives, alongside million-dollar salaries, annual bonuses, and slugs of stock or options. Many corporate officers are allowed to take the same jets on vacation to visit relatives or commute from other homes, and some can fly family and friends, all at company expense. Boards often require CEOs to fly corporate both on and off the job, calling it safer and more efficient. The perk can be a big draw in compensation packages, aviation and compensation consultants say. "It's one of the few status symbols you don't get tired of," said Christopher Hewitt, a retired public company executive who helped draft flight perk disclosures as a corporate attorney and enjoyed his own trips on company planes. Spending on the perk has doubled since 2019 at companies that reported providing it last year, outpacing the overall growth in business jet travel. Under federal securities rules, companies must report as compensation the aggregate incremental cost of perquisites such as free personal flights. Most say they count expenses directly tied to a specific trip, including fuel, landing fees, airport taxes, catering, crew lodging and meals, and an hourly rate for maintenance, plus the cost of repositioning empty aircraft for later use, security filings show. The value of personal flights that companies disclose does not affect company or executives' taxes. Typically left out, fixed costs that don't change by flying more, including pilot salaries, insurance, and the cost of acquiring the aircraft. Companies say they would pay these costs anyway because the aircraft are primarily used for business. Charter companies charge customers thousands of dollars an hour to fly on similar jets, fees set to cover both the incremental costs reported by the executive's employers as well as fixed costs, and a margin for profit. The result, a gulf between what executives save by taking personal flights in the company jet and what companies report spending. Disney Aviation Group, a unit of the entertainment company that flies executives and other employees, has registered three Gulfstream G650 jets and a Gulfstream G600 with the Federal Aviation Administration. With a crew of two, each can seat as many as 18 to 19 passengers depending on configuration and rank among the biggest and costliest business jets in regular use. Flying them can cost over $5,000 an hour in the incremental expenses that companies add up when disclosing executives' personal flight costs. That means Iger's personal flights last year, which cost Disney $794,000, worked out to about 130 hours of flight time, or around 2.5 hours a week. That figure likely includes time spent moving empty aircraft in connection with personal trips. Chartering similar aircraft can cost $12,000 to $20,000 an hour, according to data from companies and brokers that help passengers charter private aircraft. At those rates, Iger's personal flights last year would have cost him $2 million or more. Charter rates can vary widely by season, geography, and other factors. Still, charter costs are the only apple-to-apple comparison for flying in a corporate jet, said Aaron Glassman, who heads a management and technology department at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, a private institution emphasizing aviation with campuses in Daytona Beach, Florida, and Prescott, Arizona. Executives often wind up chartering planes when they can't use the companies, he said. That is plan B, and executives have to do that with some regularity. The $1 million Netflix reported spending on 2022 on personal flights for Hastings works out to more than 220 hours aloft based on its fleet last year. At the time, Netflix flew aircraft including Gulfstream V-Jets and Beech King Air turboprops. The company said it shed two of the aircraft last year. And that is the news from the front page of the Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. I'm Jenny Pleman, and until next time, stay healthy and keep safe.